I'm going to say this, and then we're going to talk about it, all right? If central banks were businesses, the way they're being run right now, they would be out of business. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Thursday, I do believe, the 23rd day of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody, with the obligatory disclaimer here that governments are not businesses and should definitely not be run as if they were. There is some truth in the idea with which we opened today, that global central banks have basically been having trouble meeting their performance targets. The proximate cause of that idea was news from the European Central Bank this morning that, while holding its key interest rate steady, a negative rate, by the way, which we have talked about, if you remember that. But anyway, while not making a rate change, the ECB is going to take a long, hard look at its monetary policy strategy. That is, how it thinks about things like inflation and even how it talks about what it's doing. If that sounds familiar, that's because it's exactly what Jay Powell and the gang at the Federal Reserve are doing. And they are doing it, the Fed and the ECB, because they have been wrong about inflation and wrong about wages and wrong about growth for years now. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer starts us off.
Central banks in the U.S. and Europe use a key tool to control inflation, raising and lowering interest rates. But that hasn't been so effective lately. The European Central Bank is trying to find out why and whether it needs to factor things like climate change into its economic models. ECB President Christine Lagarde says she's also looking for answers from the public.
Really, to be able to listen to the expectations of the people, to better understand the economic concerns.
Lagarde says it'll be like the Federal Reserve's listening tours. They're part of a review the Fed is doing of its policies. So, are central banks admitting they made some mistakes and need new strategies, or has the global economy changed so much that even the best tools won't work?
Well, could be a little of both.
Frank Notaft is a former Fed economist, now chief economist at CoreLogic. Notaft says the central banks were slow to recognize the financial crisis, but eventually expanded their toolkits.
So I just think periodically, a refresh, a review, I think that's just a good practice in general.
And the world has changed a lot. Georgetown Government and Foreign Service Professor Kathleen McNamara says there's one theory that increased productivity from technology will keep inflation low no matter what central banks do.
And there isn't the sort of room that we used to have for pressure on prices and wages.
The Federal Reserve and European Central Bank reviews are expected to be wrapped up later this year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Arguably the best thing about the World Economic Forum in Davos is that so many heavy hitters are gathered in one place for so short a period of time that pretty much every day something of note gets said. Today, it was David Solomon, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, who told CNBC that starting this year, Goldman's not going to help take any companies public unless those companies have at least one diverse board candidate with, Solomon said, a focus on women. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more on efforts to diversify the boardroom.
A company's board of directors oversees big strategy decisions. So having a diversity of perspectives in the room matters, says Aaron Essenmacher with the National Association of Corporate Directors.
If you're not thinking differently about who's sitting around the table, then you're probably not thinking differently about other big questions that can really hurt your business.
Goldman Sachs CEO said firms with at least one woman on the board perform better. And while academic research on the issue has been inconclusive, the move of such a major player could change the calculus of many companies, says Allison Elias at the Wharton School of Business.
I think that this Goldman decision is symbolic of the strength of the business case and the belief people have in it.
Only about a quarter of board seats at Fortune 500 companies are currently held by women, but things have slowly started to change in recent years, says Lee Hansen, a vice president at executive search firm Heidrick & Struggles.
The market is clearly demanding. It is the overriding thing we are being asked for in boards.
Women and other underrepresented groups still face many challenges in being appointed to boards, says Elisa Norris with Women Corporate Directors. Board nominees are often expected to have CEO or previous board experience.
So there's fewer women with the board experience when you think about the pool.
She hopes moves like Goldman Sachs can help turn that vicious cycle into a more virtuous one. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Goldman, by the way, has 4 women on its board. That's out of 11 directors. Ticker symbol GS, in case you're curious, off about 0.6% today, mixed on the major indices. Details, numbers, when we get there. We told you a couple of weeks ago that the average FICO score in this economy hit an all-time high last year, FICO scores being one of the key measurements of consumer creditworthiness. Well, today, with the caveat, I guess that's 2 caveats in the program today, the caveat that correlation is not causality, the company behind the FICO score, that is Fair Isaac, announced it is going to change the way it figures those scores and conceivably lower the FICO scores of tens of millions of people, thus making it more expensive for them to borrow. Dot Kelly lectures in personal finance at the University of Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So as you saw this story come out today, what were your thoughts? Why is this happening?
Well, FICO, or Fair Isaac Corporation, is like any other corporation. They're constantly improving their services and products and offering new things to their clients who are lenders. So they offer this service, a credit score, and they're trying to appeal to their lenders and give them a better product.
And those lenders are going to use this product then to generate revenue for themselves, right? I mean, this is a business transaction, right?
Exactly. Okay. It's a capitalist society.
Yes, it is. Thank you for listening to this program. So who wins and who loses with these changes?
Well, according to what FICO is saying, is that the lenders are going to win. Their new model is going to be more predictive and provide better accuracy that will allow them to minimize or reduce their defaults and delinquencies.
Consumers, though, I mean, if I'm an average person in this economy with a FICO score somewhere, you know, middling, how am I doing?
Depends on what kind of person you are. According to FICO, it's going to affect 110 million consumer credit scores.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. But some of them, about 40%, will see an increase because the big change is it's going to not look at your balances for 1 month. It's going to look at your balances over 24 months.
Uh-huh.
So if you've been paying off your balances regularly, no problem. But if you've had some hiccups or you've been late, it's going to see that. And those people are going to be flagged as being a higher risk.
What does that mean systemically in this economy? And as you know, we're, you know, just barely 10 years out from a huge financial crisis. Debt was a huge part of it. Credit has been, you know, loosening up a little bit. Is this going to tighten it?
It could. It could. And I think that is not necessarily a bad thing. Right now, defaults on car loans have been much higher. And in fact, severe delinquencies, that's more than 60 days on subprime car loans, hit a record high in December. So continuing to lend to people who may not be able to meet those obligations mm-hmm. is not a good idea for anybody, really.
So with the acknowledgement that, you know, credit is a business, a very big business in this economy, mm-hmm. let me circle back to where you started, which is that these lenders now will have more options and be able to get more business, more revenue. Is that what we need right now in this economy, is for banks and lenders to be stronger?
Yeah, actually, it's to help them minimize the risk.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure they would like more business, but that's part of the problem with lending money.
Right.
And this, in theory, is going to help the lenders minimize the risk by reducing the default rates.
Dot Kelly, she's a lecturer in personal finance at the University of Virginia. Ms. Kelly, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The U.S. Conference of Mayors is meeting this week in Washington. Various and sundry things on the agenda, of course. The social safety net, workforce development, immigration. Also, the current state of Opportunity Zones. That's a program in the GOP's tax bill from a couple of years ago designed to encourage investment in low-income communities through tax incentives. Designed to is the key phrase there, of course. From WBEZ in Chicago, Natalie Moore looked at how the program is starting to play out in Illinois.
A 400-square-foot building is under construction in Pullman, a Chicago residential neighborhood with high unemployment. The industrial space could be a warehouse or a logistical center. There's no tenant yet, but the building is scheduled to open in April.
It's a $35 million project, and when we started it a couple years ago, you know, we were looking at different financing tools and different ways to structure this.
David Doig is president of Chicago Neighborhood Initiatives. The nonprofit has ushered in developments from big box retail to artist housing in this Black Southside community. But it was having trouble finding financing for this latest industrial building located near a cleaning factory and youth sports center. Then Allstate, the insurance company, offered to fund the industrial project in exchange for tax breaks. That's the idea behind Opportunity Zones. Doig says the incentives...
They're just that. They're a tool.
The state of Illinois determined the 133 Opportunity Zones in Chicago, the census tracts where investors can now qualify for those tax breaks. Here's how it works. Opportunity zones allow private investors and for-profit companies to defer or reduce taxes on their capital gains by investing in projects in economically distressed areas, like the Pullman neighborhood, where Doig's project is located.
Are they the be-all and end-all? Are they going to solve all of our problems? No.
Still, Doig says it's a useful program. But critics say there isn't enough oversight. Currently, the IRS sets tax guidelines for investors, but the government does not track things like job creation or how much economic development results from those investments.
It is pretty agnostic about what type of investment it's incentivizing.
Brett Theodos studies opportunity zones for the Urban Institute in Washington, D.C. Theodos testified before Congress last fall about changing the program to build in more accountability. And he says,
I'm encouraging localities, states, philanthropies, impact investors, and others to co-invest in projects that are more clearly going to produce a community benefit.
Since there's no oversight system, it's hard to pinpoint which projects have received Opportunity Zone investment money in Illinois. The Chicago Housing Authority did. It's using Opportunity Zone money from co-investor PNC Bank to add a commercial building to a mixed-income housing site. The commercial space will include restaurants and a health office. Michael Gorgoni is chief investment officer for the agency.
Quite likely this would not have been done without the incentive provided by the Opportunity Zones because of the large influx of capital needed in these depressed areas. The Opportunity Zone is really kind of a but-for instrument.
In other words, but for the Opportunity Zone, the public housing agency would not see $12.5 million invested. In Chicago, I'm Natalie Moore from Marketplace.
Coming up.
That had to figure out where exactly it was when it's in front of a wall.
Building a robot that can build a wall. Spoiler alert here, gang. Harder than you think. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 26 today, less than a tenth percent. Closed at 29,160. And the NASDAQ gained 18 points, about two-tenths percent, 94.02. The S&P 500 up 3 points, a tenth percent, 33.25. Some travel stocks rebounded after the World Health Organization said it's too early to consider the coronavirus outbreak in China, quote, a public health emergency of international concern, end of quote. Delta Airlines up 1%, United improved 1.8%. Casino operator Las Vegas Sands and Melco Resorts both have big business interests in China. Las Vegas Sands unchanged. Melco tumbled 4.9% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note, thanks for asking, fell to 1.73%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Procter & Gamble, the consumer products conglomerate, reported earnings this morning. Not as good as Wall Street had been guessing, not terrible, though. Healthcare, home care, and skin products in particular did well. And as Marketplace's Justin Ho reports, a lot of those lines have kind of an old-fashioned ring to them.
Procter & Gamble brands that showed the strongest growth included Vicks, Crest Toothpaste, Olay, which started out with a different name.
Oil of Olay. It can help you look younger, too.
The success of those older brands is noteworthy considering that for years, younger consumers have been moving toward newer products, perceived as less commercial and more authentic. But Yale marketing professor Ravi Dhar says that trend hasn't affected all industries equally.
You saw this trend a lot more in the food industry than in the detergent or family care and toothpaste.
To draw in younger customers, Dhar says Procter & Gamble has been focusing on innovation. Olay has been pushing high-tech skin treatments. Crest has a new toothpaste formula for sensitive teeth. Tide has pods.
Innovation comes in many different forms, and I think sort of aligning it to the consumer is what they have done much better in the last couple of years.
And there's a broader reason why many of those old school brands have managed to stay relevant, says Brian Owens at Kantar Retail.
What we're seeing is that more of the established brands are changing more of their narrative.
Brands like Olay have focused more on sustainable and inclusive messaging in order to target younger customers. And it's not just commercials. Owen says Procter & Gamble has been pushing this message to younger consumers on newer platforms like social media. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Today, from the Marketplace desk of My How Time Flies, Saturday makes it 1 year since the end of the longest shutdown of the federal government ever. 35 days of closed national parks, lost economic activity, and hundreds of thousands of government employee and contractor furloughs. Sunny Blaylock is one of those contractors. She designs e-learning programs for the State Department. We talked to her at the time a year ago. We figured this might be a good moment to check back in.
So when the shutdown hit, it just kind of took the wind out of my sails. And, you know, it was hard. It was hard for my family. Over the last year, it has caused me to reflect and think about my long-term plan for myself and for my family. And I've come to the conclusion that I need to be the boss of myself. And I'm planning on starting my own e-learning business. And I've been talking to entrepreneurs that I've known and met through the years and figuring out a way so that I can control my own destiny. It is frightening, the thought of leaving a comfortable job that I love and trying something new. But because that shutdown happened, I mean, I recognize that I have to do hard things to take control of myself and not, you know, not be at the whim of like government shutting down or some contract ending. Like if I want to complain about it, then I need to fix it, which means figuring out how to do my own thing. And that's risky for me career-wise, but you know, I already went through risk career-wise with the shutdown. And, you know, after you taste that, it's not so bad. And I'm not as scared to try new things.
Sunny Blaylock. There, she's a federal contractor, at least for now, in Arlington, Virginia. A lot of the time when we talk about startups on this program, we're talking tech startups, right? And the things that those startups are building is usually an app with code and all that. Not to say that that's not hard work, but not all startups are Uber, right? Sometimes startups are, I don't know, a robot company trying to build a robot that can build brick walls. And while the non-bricklaying and non-robot-making public might think to itself, come on, how hard can it be? Turns out it can be pretty hard. Jonathan Waldman tells the story of a startup trying to do it in his new book. It's called SAM, One Robot, A Dozen Engineers, and the Race to Revolutionize the Way We Build. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
I want to start with a basic thing here, because it escaped my understanding, and my guess would be others as well. The difference between a robot and a machine, and which one is SAM?
I like that question because a lot of people have been identifying SAM as somehow containing AI, which it does not. Uh-huh. As far as a robot and a machine, doesn't really make a difference to me.
Okay, fair enough. I'm sure robot scientists will write to us and object, but that's fine. I'll take that hit. Now, here's the second part of this question, and it goes to what this gizmo, SAM, does. And I watched a couple of videos, and I read the book, and I'm confused about why this was so hard, because fundamentally all this thing is doing is slapping some cement on a brick and slapping it on a wall. Discuss.
Yeah, it seems really easy. It lays bricks about 400 bricks an hour, but it can do that all day and all night. And the two parts of it that were really hard is it had to figure out where exactly it was when it's in front of a wall. And then they also had to figure out how the heck do you pump mortar out of a tube onto a brick, because that's also not the way people do it. They put mud down on a wall first and put a brick on top of the mud.
Mud being bricklayer talk for cement, right? Or concrete, whatever it is.
Yeah. And a mudslinger being bricklayer talk for a bricklayer.
Gotcha. There is a whole part of this interview that we could get into about the bricklayer subculture, but we won't, except to say this. You mentioned 400 bricks an hour. Speed matters with bricklayers and thus for what this machine can do because it goes to how fast you can build.
Yep. It's probably the biggest thing in construction. Everything gets delayed for any number of reasons out there, and if you can build faster, you can make more money.
Can we do a little biographical sketch here of Scott Peters, the guy who is the visionary is fair enough. How did bricks come to be his passion?
So his father-in-law is a project manager for a construction firm. And in 96, he was working on a job in Syracuse and kept saying to himself, there's got to be a better way. And he sat on the notion for about 10 years until he finally met his daughter's boyfriend. And then they started going back and forth and scheming it up and talking to people who could help them build a robot. And it turns out Scott's a pretty talented inventor.
So let's get through the development and testing of this thing. And it's a narrative tale that I will not spoil. But suffice it to say, it was not easy to come up with this machine and thus, as you say in the subtitle of this book, revolutionize the way we build.
It was not easy. A lot of engineers around the world have kind of had this fantasy of building a machine that can pick up blocks and put them where they're supposed to go. The engineers who designed this machine could get it to work in their office, and as soon as they brought it to the field, they faced a pretty steep learning curve.
Talk to me about the biz dev portion of this project, right, business development. He went out and he said, hey, I've got a robot that lays bricks. What was the response?
A lot of guys screamed in his face or walked out of the room. A lot of guys said, I'm too busy to talk and maybe some other time. A few people said, we'll give it a shot. I know you want to try it for 6 months. Maybe you could try it for 2 weeks. And then Scott, meanwhile, was trying to figure out if he should rent machines or sell machines or start his own masonry company or license the software he developed. He's sort of trying to figure out all of it at once.
So you look at videos of this thing and you read this book and you realize that maybe they only got halfway there because what they wanted to do was build a machine that could build walls, right? Could lay bricks by itself. And what they got was a thing that helps humans build walls because there's human beings surrounding this machine.
Yeah, and actually it was pretty funny because they always knew that developing a fully autonomous robot would basically be impossible. But even developing a semi-autonomous robot was really hard and sort of guarantees that it's going to need a person to either to load bricks and to load mortar but also to strike the joints between the bricks that go down. And even that still sort of pissed off a lot of masons, but it's not about to throw them out of jobs.
It's funny that what looks to be such a Herculean effort by this little company winds up having marginal impact.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I actually sort of think what's happened is that the futurists and the talk that they use have sort of gotten to all of us. There's a lot of hype out there with technology. And I think it's worth sort of slowing down and instead of looking ahead, look at where we actually are right now.
And the reality is that there's a certain amount of rote in this economy that we just have to do, and it can't all be Facebook getting 2 billion people. Sometimes it's putting mud on a brick.
I think exactly that.
It's a book called Sam. It's about a robot. It's about a machine that lays bricks, but really it's about a lot more than that. Jonathan Waldman wrote it. Jonathan, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We've got an excerpt of Jonathan's book and a video of Sam in action, which is totally worth a click, by the way. Marketplace.org is where you can find it. This final note on the way out today, this whole hullabaloo about Mr. Peanut being dead. First of all, don't believe it for a second, y'all. That Super Bowl commercial that the whole thing is a teaser for is totally going to wind up with him miraculously alive somehow. Also, to put tongue further in cheek, there was this today from one of my favorite Twitter feeds. It's at Crime A Day, which, just like it sounds, is a daily feed of things that can make you a federal criminal. Here's the tweet from today. 18 U.S. Code Section 1014 and 7 Code of Federal Regulation Section 457 make it a federal crime to make a false peanut insurance claim to the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation for a loss of peanuts. Okay, we're going. Dow Industrials off 26 today. That's less than a 10%. The NASDAQ up 18 points, 0.2%. Another record high, by the way, on the NASDAQ. S&P 500 gained 3. That's about a 10% there. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, and John Gordon are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.